the first oral argument case for the en banc court today is Pedro Rodriguez versus the State of Nevada, number 63423. Are counsel ready to proceed?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, please proceed.
Mr. Chief Justice, may I please the court? My name is David Neidert. I have the responsibility of representing Pedro Rodriguez in his appeal following a resentencing where a jury for the second time sentenced him to death. The facts of the case are egregious, and I'm not trying to hide them. In fact, I set forth the facts as found by this court in my opening brief as a statement of facts. I supplemented those with the other aggravating evidence that was established at the new penalty hearing. And I did all that because even with the egregious facts of this murder and my client's clear culpability and guilt under a felony murder theory, there still are issues that suggest that that third time may have to be the charm with respect to this case. The first issue that really screams out for review is the motion to relieve counsel and how Judge Adams handled that request. I don't like to criticize judges if I don't have to, but when this issue was brought up approximately a month before the new penalty hearing, Judge Adams handled the request to relieve counsel in a rather unusual manner. He basically told my client, who was already claiming that he was having a strained relationship with Mr. Picker, that in order to bring his complaints before the court, he had to waive the attorney-client privilege so that they could talk about why there was a conflict. Now, I'm critical of that because there were other ways that Judge Adams could have handled the issue and did not. The easiest way it could have been handled is a way that that Judge Sattler actually handled it in a case involving me and a client who was dissatisfied with my services. And in that case, Judge Sattler sealed the courtroom, basically told the district attorney and the person from PNP that they could leave. And then he held a hearing where he could talk to me and my client to see if there was such a conflict that it required the replacement of myself as this other person's attorney.
Did Picker ask for that?
Then Picker did not ask for that, and perhaps Picker should have asked for that, but that's an issue for post-conviction relief and not for direct appeal. But no, Picker did not ask for that. But in my case, I didn't ask
for
that.
Why do you say we have to wait? Why do we have to wait for post-conviction relief if you're raising the issue of failure to relieve counsel? And it wasn't raised. In other words, there's some of my colleagues don't like to handle issues that aren't raised in the district court.
Well, I raised it in the context, and I raised it sort of as part of this motion on the motion to relieve counsel, and how Judge Adams dealt with that particular issue. I disagree with the sense that was expressed that it was a request to delay. This was a case that had been delayed for other reasons for almost 3 years.
Wasn't this a discretionary move? When I was a district court judge, I did the same thing that the other judge did as far as
as far as getting the DA out of the picture. And I even did something else. I sent it to the chief judge and let the chief judge of the 8th District handle those issues, and then it would come back to me as the trial judge. But there's no wrong way here. That's the thing about relieving counsel. There's no – nothing says it's – what's wrong? What's the case law that said what he did is wrong?
I'm not saying what he did is wrong. I'm saying that what you did – well, you did actually a better practice, I think, than what Judge Sattler did, but I thought Judge Sattler's practice was better than what I think Judge Adams did in this case. So I'm not saying that there's case law that says you have to seal the courtroom, you have to send it to the chief judge, anything of that nature. This court has never said that. And I would be remiss if I said the court has held something that it's never held.
Why wouldn't Young v. State apply here and you evaluate those factors? What was the indication there was a complete collapse of an attorney-client relationship? And what the basis was for the motion for the substitution? It's not real clear to me, but it looks like he's contending there was a breakdown of the relationship because he wasn't insisting on more plea negotiations, and the district attorney's office came back and said, well, we're not prepared to do that anymore.
Well, and I think that's that becomes a trust issue. And I evaluated this case using the Young factors in my brief. But I think part of that is a trust issue, and it sort of ties in to Missouri versus Seifert and the obligation of defense counsel to take plea offers, no matter how bad they think they are to their client, because their client is the ultimate person who controls whether they're going to accept a plea or not accept a plea.
Is this really a question about taking plea offers to the client or taking clients' counteroffers back to the state?
And this is a counteroffer back to the state, but it seems that that's a logical corollary.
But didn't the district attorney's office already said, we're done, we're not going to negotiate anymore? In fact, there's indications that Rodriguez routinely scuttled deals and changed his mind. They said, we're done. What's wrong with that? And if counsel thought it was futile to go back to the state and make a request after that kind of an indication, what's wrong with that?
Well, I think counsel should be required. I mean, even if they think it's a stupid offer. I mean, I have my clients in my private practice all the time say, well, gee, I'd like this. And I tell them, you're probably not going to get that.
Right.
But if you want me to ask, I will.
Sure.
And it wouldn't have taken Mr. Picker much to keep his client happy to call the prosecutor on the case and say, hey, my client wants life with. And then to say, no, we're not going there. And then the communication would have occurred.
Counsel, isn't it also true that a colloquy existed between Mr. Picker and the court, wherein Mr. Picker clearly represented that notwithstanding what his client might suggest was a breakdown in that attorney-client relationship, that he could still represent that defendant with the full degree of advocacy that is required of him, and that he, frankly, did not feel that the relationship had broken down to a point where it needed to be severed. And isn't that also something that this court looks at?
Sure, and I'm not discounting that colloquy occurred, because it certainly did. I'm not going to say that something didn't happen when the record clearly says that it did. I acknowledge that there's no requirement. The Ninth Circuit was very clear to have a meaningful relationship between a criminal defendant and their attorney. And I can say,
so I guess the question, if I can even be so bold as to sum up what I think I'm hearing across the bench here, is what standard, if you were writing a disposition here, if you could win here today, how would it read? We would require the judge to do what in the inquiry into this alleged breakdown in the relationship? We would require the counsel to do what? How would that read?
Well, I think it goes back to what I first started with. I would think that that first of all, there should be a way for there to be a more candid discussion between defense counsel and the client and the judge or some judge with respect to what's bothering without making the district attorney privy to those communications.
So that would be new law, number one.
And I'm not suggesting that is otherwise. But I think that's the first step, and that step didn't happen in this case.
Well, I mean, no problem with the Young factors. Contrary to the law that exists, if you look at Moore through the Ninth Circuit and you look at Gallego, that's contrary to your position right now.
and applied to new law. I mean, I understand that.
Retreating or overruling existing law, and you want to, I'm just not sure I see a good basis to do that.
I would be interested, this is a complete change of subject, but I would like to hear your thoughts on the issue of his co-defendants not receiving the death penalty and the admissibility of that evidence. I understand in a normal situation, I can't hook up the relevance of that if it weren't a death penalty situation at all. So it would be unique to death penalty law. But you look at the case law on that, there's a clear split, and perhaps you could develop that point a bit more for me and my colleagues.
I'd be more than happy to. And that is an issue where there is actually, you're right, a very clear split in authority. Different appellate courts have looked at this in different ways. And it was an issue that was fully preserved by, and in fact, Judge Adams initially ruled this. I think it's relevant. That was the first part. And then he said, but. And so Judge Adams' ruling was, it's relevant, but I think it's too confusing.
Well, tell me what it's relevant to and why this jury should have heard it.
I think it's relevant in the sense that a jury of people that are non-attorneys are tasked with making an extraordinarily difficult decision whether or not somebody should be executed. And I think in doing that, the jurors are entitled to know basically anything that the defense wants to present about the client. In this case, for example, that Mr. Rodriguez had an absolutely horrific childhood and things of that nature. But I think they also want to be aware and should be aware of what happened with the co-defendants, because they're hearing about these other people. With respect to the one co-defendant, there was the spectacle in the trial of him being brought in from the prison and him refusing to cooperate at all, and on that basis, his entire testimony from the readback being presented to the jury. And so the jury is going to want to know what does this guy stack up with respect to the co-defendants. And in this case, the state has created a horrible. It would have been, I would acknowledge, slightly misleading, but it certainly would have been a correct statement of the law that both Mr. Servin and the other co-defendant were under the age of 18 at the time this crime was committed, and so they're not eligible for the death penalty.
Mr. Neenan, I'd like to explore the suggestion that there's actually a split of authority. Aren't the states in which, by and large, the states in which this co-defendant sentence is admissible premised on a state statute that provides for that, which is not present in Nevada?
Off the top of my head,
I don't see in those cases that they have initiated that rule based upon a constitutional premise or some other premise other than an existing state statute, such as in Alabama or Arizona. Can you comment on that? Do you have a case where the split is premised on a constitutional right, or either state or federal?
And I honestly do not. I can't, off the top of my head, answer that question.
Well, hasn't this issue been handled in this state in a case called Guy versus State, Curtis Guy, who was not the person who actually murdered the other person, but it was a felony murder, and he's been on death row for a long time. So we've solved that. In fact, he was offered something other than death. He was offered second degree and turned it down. So isn't that issue been decided? In other words, we'd have to throw away stare decisis, which we don't do very lightly.
Was that on this particular issue, or an issue on whether on the felony murder issue? Because I think those are separate issues.
Well, no, Guy was a carjacking, and Guy was the one who actually executed the victim in this matter. It was a co-defendant. So it seems that we
you know, we allow that to happen here, where someone who's not the the actual perpetrator of the homicide, but for felony murder to get death, and the perpetrator gets life.
And that's a separate issue. I mean, well, that's a, that the one issue had to deal with Judge Adams and dealing with the issue and whether the co-defendant sentences are should be told to the jury, and that's the issue that Judge Adams changed his mind on. And there's the other issue, which I think you're talking about, if I'm mistaken, as to what under the felony murder rule, whether the non-shooter should be death eligible.
No, but Justice Jerry's point has to do with proportionality review, and does Guy answer that question?
I would have to know that to some degree it does, yes.
So to the extent that the issue is premised either on state law in other jurisdictions or is not premised on constitutional review, wouldn't our review of Judge Adams' decision be based on abuse of discretion as opposed to a constitutional error?
And I don't think I claimed a constitutional error in my brief.
No, I didn't see that.
So you're not trying to link this up as either mitigating or going to the nature of the crime. I'm struggling with trying to make that connection, but
I think it goes somewhat to both, but in the sense that here are these other people that were equally legally culpable for this crime, and here's what's happened to them, and so now you decide what's happened to this person.
How could you persuade me and my colleagues that, first of all, do you agree that our review is for abuse of discretion on just Judge Adams' decision to exclude evidence of the sentences given the co-defendants?
Well, I think...
Or not? Are you arguing it's legal error or constitutional error?
Well, I think in its own sort of unique way, it goes to the nature of the crime in the sense of what happened to the co-defendants.
Okay, so you're saying that it was a legal error because it related to the nature of the crime, and the U.S. Supreme Court authority is you should allow in
basically anything with the nature of the crime or the background of the
and defendant. Persuade us that it really is a nature of the crime or a mitigating.
Well, I think in the sense that you have three different people who are equally culpable. And I
kind of get the moral argument, but what I'm having trouble on is pretty much what Justice Hardesty's saying, and that is there are standards for the admission of evidence. If there was no legal error committed, our review is for abuse of discretion, and that's a very tough uphill row for you to hoe. It's very difficult. If, on the other hand, there's legal error and you can say, under the applicable standards, this really should have come in because it is part of the nature of the crime or an evidence of mitigation. It's a bit of a reach for me to make it mitigation, but I mean, I could invent arguments, I suppose, that it qualified as that. I agree with you. I think it's troubling that if I were the sentencing jury, I would like to know that the other two co-defendants, including the actual shooter, were not sentenced to death, just on a pure moral level. But I'm not applying moral law. I'm trying to apply constitutional or statutory law. So.
And in my brief, I raised it as this is mitigating evidence. And the argument of the brief is under Penry and the line of the Supreme Court cases as to what the jury should be allowed to consider in a sentencing decision. And I acknowledge that there's another troubling aspect that I'm not addressed by anybody. With my proposed rule is if you have two co-defendants and they're being tried separately, one would get the benefit of something that the other one would not. So, I mean, I understand that my proposed rule has its problems as well.
Yeah, because the first guy is going to be tried.
The first guy is going to be tried without knowing that the other case is sort of hanging in the background without any knowing what's going to happen to the second defendant. And the other issue, I'll just spend a minute on it before I go over to Ms. McCarthy and reserve time for rebuttal, is the issue on that I am clearly asking this court to overturn prior decisions, is the issue that Justice Cherry mentioned, at least in passing, and that has to do with the person in a felony murder situation who is not the actual shooter being eligible for the death penalty at all. And I understand and respect that for that rule to change, it would require this court to overrule its precedent. But it's also, when I was researching the issue, I was amazed at how freakish that occurrence actually was, where a co-defendant who's the actual shooter does not get sentenced to death, and the defendant who is not the shooter is, and even more freakish where the executions actually happen in those situations. And so I would suggest that at least under the evolving standards, and I know that's something judges hate, that perhaps that line of cases should be reviewed. On that, I'll reserve the remainder of my time and respond to anything Mr. McCarthy says.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Nugent. Mr. McCarthy.
Good morning, Mr. Chief Justice, Justices of the Supreme Court. I'm Terry McCarthy, Deputy DA from Washoe County, on behalf of the state. And the notion that Judge Adams erred in not throwing the DA out of the courtroom is being raised for the first time now. It was mentioned in the brief, but there's certainly no argument, no assignment of error, nothing for me to respond to, and so I haven't. If I have to respond to it now, I'd say that since no one asked, it's not mandatory. As to the waiver of the attorney-client privilege, similarly, that's raised for the first time in oral argument, but that is the ethical rule. The lawyer is relieved of the attorney-client privilege to the extent necessary to respond to allegations of wrongdoing. Finally, on the subject of...
Was there anything in the record in the penalty phase or argument of counsel that drew upon information developed during the colloquy between Rodriguez and the court and Picker about the conflict?
I can't recall anything like that. I'd be shocked if there was such a thing. I would like to mention also that there was a finding. This is not about extend the counteroffer back to the DA, because there was a finding that counsel had fully discharged his duties, that they had done what was supposed to be done. They had been negotiating for 3 years and had been unable to reach a conclusion. But anyway, there's a finding based on the statements of Mr. Hahn, my new boss, and Mr. Picker, that they had done what they were supposed to do. They had extended all offers, and they had been rejected. And so applying the Young factors there, if there was a breakdown in the attorney-client relationship, which I don't see, there's also no basis for it. That is, if this defendant decided to be mistrustful, he did that for no reason of his own, or no reason at all, and so the courts aren't required to accommodate him and give him yet another lawyer. Now, this case has a tortured procedural history. I think we've used up not all the lawyers in the county, but a substantial number of them. Anyway, but there's no error in failing to discharge Picker and appoint someone else.
I need you to humor me for a second.
Of course.
In reading the record, it seems like there was a lot of mitigation put on in this case, loads of mitigation. And I want you to humor me and allow me to say that there was a violation of due process by not allowing the jury to hear the mitigating factor of the fact that the co-defendant did not receive death, yet he was the main perpetrator. Now tell me why this would be harmless error beyond a reasonable doubt in this particular case.
Well, first, one of those other defendants was indeed sentenced to death.
Okay.
So there was a jury of 12 that sentenced him to death.
That's why I said you got to humor me a little bit.
I understand. So, I'm having trouble doing that. But if assuming that the Constitution demanded that, and why was it harmless? Well, All because they were alive. The jury heard they were alive, and so that's, they got the message.
But don't, as a district attorney yourself, don't you believe that that's a mitigating factor, that the jury should hear about the possibility that there'll be unequal sentencing of co-defendants?
No, I don't. I don't at all, and I think it'd be dangerous to allow that. More importantly,
I know it'd be dangerous if the first guy got the death penalty and the second guy you're shooting for life, and the jury finds out, you know, the goose gander rule. What's good for the goose is good for the gander.
Well, that's coming too. There's a case working its way through here, so I'll probably be back for that one.
I look forward to it.
And in that case, I'll announce the same proposition I have now, and that is it's addressed to the sound discretion of the trial court. It's neither excluded nor mandated, and the judge can decide in each case whether it's appropriate. In this case, it was inappropriate because it would have opened the doors to so much other explanation. How do we explain to a jury the role of this court in reversing the sentence of the 16-year-old?
But the way we do the death penalty in this state, and I had so many incidents when I was in private practice and as a court-appointed attorney, where first of all you get the aggravating circumstances, then you get all the background stuff, all the junk. And certainly by letting somebody know in this particular case that the co-defendant got life, what's the harm there? What's the problem? Why would Adam say it's relevant and then decide not to let it in? What did he say?
Well, he said it was too confusing because...
What's confusing about it? It's confusing when you bring in a bunch of other stuff other than just the aggravating circumstances. What about the whole background of the defendant that comes in?
I'm not
fine. Good and the bad. Right. Why is it confusing to a jury that the co-defendant got life?
Well, because it would necessarily, I think, in all fairness, it would require then allowing a full explanation of what the difference is. You know, we can explain to this jury.
But jury two begins to retry jury one's decision.
Yeah. Do we want that? I think not. I think it's unwise. I wouldn't go as far as California. California just says absolutely not. Can't do it under no circumstances. Well, I think there probably are circumstances in which it would be appropriate, but not here. And not, I guess I'm just saying that the rules of evidence don't go down the tubes simply because it's a capital sentencing hearing. Judges have authority. They have authority to decide that this is too much trouble, that it is going to be confusing because we have to explain. We have to explain that one fellow was sentenced to death and then it was reversed. What's the role of the Supreme Court in reversing a death sentence? I mean, I don't think I'd want to explain that to a first-year law student, and I damn sure don't want to explain it to a jury. So, and by the way, that was before the U.S. Supreme Court had just outlawed the execution of juveniles. This court didn't do it because it was juvenile. They did it because it was just too high. The sentence was excessive. Now, how do we explain that, and what's the difference? What made it excessive? Was it the lack of mitigation? Well, now we're going to have that trial all over again, too, to see what kind of mitigation was presented. What is the difference? What is the moral difference between these people? If you acknowledge a difference in the sentences, you're going to have to allow an argument and evidence on what is the difference, what is the reason for the difference. All of them, all the reasons. Not just that he's 16 years old or he pleaded out to a panel. Those are things that we can see clearly, but they're
isn't
not
the moral culpability, that big jury instruction that we've talked about in this forum so long, moral culpability. You know, I'm going to do a robbery with Mark, and we go into the 7-Eleven, and Mark kills the guy. I didn't expect him to kill the guy, but boy, I'm going down, just like Mark's going down. He gets life, I get death. I mean, that's moral culpability. He's moral culpability. He's got it. I'm really not morally culpable. Because I don't know, I'm not a lawyer. I'm a kid. I'm not even a kid. I'm a young adult, and I don't know about felony murder.
Well, which one has the prior rape conviction?
Right, but that returns me to my concern in this case. In this case, just because a ruling was discretionary doesn't automatically mean that it's okay. I mean, it's not just abject deference to any discretionary determination that we give. And here I'm trying to understand, and perhaps it's under the review we're supposed to do, The aggravator in this was his horrendous sexual assault of the 14-year-old girl. I mean, he has a bad record. I give you that all day long. The other piece to me that justified the death penalty was the extreme vulnerability of this victim and the terror she must have felt. And I think that's very moving also on this record. But those both apply. The sex assault doesn't, but the terror that the victim endured and so on applied equally to the co-defendants. So the differentiation, and I realize I'm slipping into proportionality here, which I shouldn't be doing, but the differentiation is the guy is a year older, 14 months older than one of them, and so he's past the 18 magic marker age, and he had a horrible sexual assault in his history, right? Is there anything else different?
There were three aggravators here.
Torture was the head wound?
I believe that's correct. There was an incision on the head, and it appears that that was inflicted by Rodriguez.
The torture wound was?
Yeah, I believe that's true.
And the escaping arrest was she would have recognized him. She didn't know the other guys from Adam, right?
She knew Rodriguez, not these other fellows. So.
Okay.
And
it's close. I mean, it's...
That's why I'm not saying it couldn't be admitted. Certainly under other matter. You know, under just...
Okay.
You know, it could be.
But to
go from there and say it must be,
right.
That's where I have to disagree.
But we do, and Justice Cherry mentions the moral culpability instruction is certainly to a non-lawyer, what does that mean? And moral culpability, it's grand and it sounds good, but what does it mean? And to kind of populate that with meaning, why wouldn't the treatment of the co-defendants be useful to a person trying to assess moral culpability? I don't know.
Because it would be relative moral culpability.
Yes,
and
okay. Yeah, you need to validate. You're right. Okay.
Because, and that means proportionality. And
so I'm coming back full circle.
Yes, and I think that there may be times when a trial judge will allow a jury to hear what has happened with other defendants.
When would be a time that you think it's appropriate and distinguish that time from this case?
Well, in this case, it was the...
We need to answer the first part first.
I'm sorry. When it would be appropriate, when there are enough similarities, when it would be helpful, then that would weigh in favor of admitting the evidence.
And the fact that it's a maybe... marginal, whether it should have been charged as death penalty, is that something that is in your calculus of when it's appropriate? Like it's real close whether this should be a death penalty case?
Actually, now we're getting into hypothetical situations because I have no problem with these aggravating...
No, I know. I'm shifting. I'm trying to understand the law that would distinguish here.
Yeah, and I don't know that you can say all the circumstances that would weigh in favor or against admission of the evidence. In the instant cases, as Judge Adams noted, there's going to be a risk of confusion of the issue simply because the response of evidence would be, in all fairness, you would have to allow the whole explanation, everything. I mean, I can see, why did this three-judge panel give a life sentence to the other fellow? Are we going to bring him in? We're going to bring him in?
Isn't that why you have the structure of the trio of cases? You've got Guy, you've got, which cited to Edmonds, and then you've got Tyson. That kind of sets up the structure for this when it's appropriate and when it's not.
Well, Guy used the phrase irrelevant. The court just found it simply irrelevant.
But there's other factors within that structure to consider.
I think that irrelevant might be going too far, but that is indeed. It would require revisiting all those prior cases, and I recommend against it, although I do recommend also that the court recognize that there are times it would be appropriate and times it would be inappropriate. And the abuse of discretion standard isn't just complete deference. this Court has said on various occasions, mainly in civil cases, that you're talking about arbitrary and capricious. If the judge had simply flipped a coin, if the judge had said, I'm allowing this in or keeping it out because it's Tuesday morning, that would be arbitrary. That would be whimsical. But he didn't. He evaluated what he's supposed to evaluate.
On that point, Mr. McCarthy, and I was waiting for you to get there, isn't that to a degree what Judge Adams did in this case? What was his explanation for why this case would not be a reasonable case to...
My recollection is he mentioned the risk of confusion of the issues, which is a standard, of course, that governs the admission of evidence. And so I would suggest that means it's not an abuse of discretion. He's doing what one's supposed to do, evaluate probative force, the risk of prejudice, risk of unfair prejudice, and things like risk of undue waste of time and confusion of the issues. And that's
let's give those terms content factually on this record. And I'm trying to press you for, and I appreciate your good responses, but I want to understand what would have been a situation where it would be appropriate to admit this testimony. Then we talk about confusion of juries and, you know, all those things that, oh, the judge had discretion, he didn't have to do that. But I'm not clear how this would have really confused the jury. You can say, look, this kid got life without, and he was however old, and the young kids get the benefit of the break here. And the jury could then figure out whether 14 months age difference is enough to say one kid, the younger of the two, should receive leniency and the older should not. Your client, the defendant, was only 19 when this happened, and I realize he was a very wicked 19-year-old, but what are the other things that make this confusing to a jury and an undue waste of time? He had a prior conviction for sexual assault. The other defendants didn't. He was 14 months older than the older of the two others. And what? He was, he knew the victim, and so he afforded the other two the opportunity to do what they did with him. Is that it? I mean, what would have had to go on to not confuse the jury?
I guess I'm saying I don't know. If we would have to ask the three-judge panel, what was different in your mind? The concept of mitigation is pretty darn broad, and I don't know what persuaded that panel. I assume it had something to do with that defendant pleading guilty, but
that's
I don't
different think. Than... Okay, so you're advocating for a rule that this never comes in because you're never going to be able to interrogate either a verdict. I mean, it's opinion evidence in a sense. You can't go back and talk to the jurors who returned the verdict of life with or life without on a co-defendant either. So the idea that they're judges and you can sometimes talk to judges more easily than jurors shouldn't change that. We still have the fact of their determination. So if you're saying in this case, if it confuses all the issues, why does it confuse all the issues apart from we'd like to talk to the three judges and on a sentenced co-defendant? I mean, it seems to me if you're going to admit this evidence in some cases, this is a pretty clean case in terms of not confusing issues because you do have the youth and the sexual assault conviction. And, I mean, I'm struggling to find out what else would be difficult here.
I think that one of the differences is that the manner in which these other people were sentenced was procedurally distinct and with different governing laws.
Okay.
To explain that, to explain the significance of those things to a sentencing panel and to a sentencing jury, I think, would be difficult at best, perhaps impossible. There's going to be cases where that's not true. I mean, where three guys are tried together, yeah. The jury's certainly going to know the outcome on each one. But in this case, because the one defendant, he was sentenced to death, and then it was reversed later on. The other defendant was pleaded guilty. He was sentenced, but not by a jury at all.
But why does that matter? I mean, ultimately, this sentencing jury might like to know that the other two co-defendants are not going to be executed. That might be helpful to them in their assessment of this.
Well, and I'd like to say, let's make it as easy as we can, but it ought to be a difficult task.
Yeah.
It should be.
It's a very difficult task.
So I guess I'm saying I can't clarify more.
Right.
Except to say that it's not an abuse of discretion. The Constitution doesn't demand it, nor does the Constitution exclude it. And so we go to the rules of evidence, and under those rules of evidence, we use an abuse of discretion standard, and when the judge applies the appropriate factors, the result should be given deference once the record shows that the judge did what he's supposed to do.
See, and I keep going back to the whole question on the constitutionality of a sentence for a defendant who didn't participate in the actual killing in the scope of what the other two did, and the importance of that aspect in the outcome of this case as a whole.
I understand. And I think the law on the subject is fairly well established, that the person who didn't personally kill can still be liable for the death penalty if you have certain findings by the jury.
What the other actors did, apart from just the mitigation aspect.
Right. Well, I want to say from time to time that there is no jury that has ever heard all possible mitigating evidence, including this one, and the next one still won't. If we went to a third sentencing hearing, that jury would still not hear all possible mitigating evidence, because that's all the knowledge of the universe, essentially. But the law does allow for disparate treatment, and it allows for death penalty for the person in a felony murder who did not personally pull the trigger. As long as certain other conditions are met, we have a jury finding that those conditions have been met. And so I suppose this court has the authority to tell the U.S. Supreme Court that they're absolutely wrong. And I wouldn't be surprised to find that it's what my friend wants this court to do. I recommend against it. So, I think I'm done. I know there are other issues, but they don't seem consequential, and so I'd be glad to discuss it more. I got another 9 minutes if you want. Otherwise,
no. I appreciate your candid responses too.
And Justice Hardesty, did I answer your question?
Yes, sir, you did. It goes along with the probing questions of other justices: to what extent or how demanding should this court be in requiring the trial judge to explain their discretionary decisions. And we impose some requirements in some contexts involving specific findings, for example. In other cases, the judge recites the appropriate standard, and that's enough. It's a slippery slope, for sure.
I would recommend to the court the notion that a silent record reveals nothing. We have a presumption of regularity. If Judge Adams had said nothing other than overruled or sustained, you would have a presumption that he approached things properly. In habitual criminal cases, I always kind of like the approach here. We say, we'll assume the judge did it right. The judge knew the call was discretionary, unless the judge said something to reveal that he didn't do it right. And I recommend that as a standard here, that if you have a silent record, you presume regularity, presume the judges know the law and apply it in their deliberations, as this court has said so many times, but only when the record affirmatively shows the court didn't know the correct standards, or affirmatively shows that the court relied on something inappropriate, some inappropriate consideration in making the decision, then you should find an abuse of discretion. So we should be looking more to the process than the result.
Any further questions for Mr. McCarthy?
Thank you very much, Mr. McCarthy. Always good to see you. Mr. Niedert, you have 9 minutes and 52 seconds to continue your discussion with us this morning.
And I can assure the court I'll be taking quite a bit less than 9 minutes and 52 seconds.
Now, you understand this isn't borrowed time for future arguments.
I fully understand that very well. I understand that when we are done today,
he would like to accumulate all of the times that he is. I'm sorry.
Mr. McCarthy probably would like to accumulate all the time. I appear so infrequently, it's not a concern. And I do think that it is a difficult issue with respect to the issue of the co-defendant sentencing. And with respect to that issue, I want to make it clear, and I made it clear in my brief, I'm not saying with respect to that issue that the fact that the two co-defendants are sentenced to life without the possibility of parole means that the jury could not sentence Mr. Rodriguez to death, having heard that evidence. Because there was, as this court acknowledged, I think as Mr. McCarthy said, other evidence that Mr. Rodriguez is not a particularly nice man. That in fact he had also committed a very horrific sexual assault, and that in fact he was the ringleader of, as it were, in this crime, and that he's the one that knew the victim, and he's the one that convinced these other two Yutzes to go with him to Ms. Fondi's house, where they terrorized her, and ultimately she was killed. So I'm not saying that it should be a rule that if one gets under this particular argument, that he was not eligible for death. And I don't want to, because as attorneys were trained to sort of argue conflicting positions at times, so I want to make it distinct from my other argument that's raised elsewhere in my brief, that the non-trigger man in a felony murder case should not be eligible for death, particularly in unique circumstances such as this one, where all the evidence this jury heard and all the evidence that I could see in meeting the first trial was that Mr. Servin was the trigger man and he did it without the direction of Mr. Rodriguez to pull the trigger.
That position is, as Mr. McCarthy suggests, and you acknowledge, contrary to existing authority. What would be the analysis that this court would engage in to repeal the stare decisis on that issue and then articulate a new rule that in every instance the active killer or the unactive killer, if you will, isn't going to be subjected to the death penalty?
Well, I do think I want to correct part of my argument. I don't think that you can say that in all circumstances the actual killer should not be subject to the death penalty. In fact, I wrote the very real analogy in my briefs, for example, that Osama bin Laden didn't kill a single person personally on 9/11, but he certainly, if he had been brought into an American courtroom, would have been highly death eligible as the ringleader on the 9/11 attacks.
Contract killers too.
And I said, and Adolf Eichmann, Israel hanged Eichmann not because he personally killed a single Jew, but because he helped plan it. And if there was evidence that Mr. Rodriguez had said, go kill the lady, which there's not that I'm aware of, that would put his case in a different perspective. I'm talking specifically about the situations where, an argument where, you know, two people go into the, you two rob the store, and he kills them, and now you're culpable.
So without overruling Guy, could we use mandatory review as a way to reverse the death penalty, or in fact just use our power to give this a defendant life without the possibility of parole?
I think this court could do that. I think the court, and I understand a court's reluctance to overrule, prior precedent. I'm not, it should never be done by this court lightly, nor would I suggest this court, should do it just on a whim, because
arguing that we do it here, so I'm trying to get from you the analysis that we would employ in an opinion that does that. I'm struggling with our jurisprudence on overturning stare decisis, and I don't quite get what is the compelling elements.
Well, and in this case,
to do it now, is there some case somewhere in America that gives an indication that Nevada's
death penalty process as it deals with felony murder cases is somehow unconstitutional today or it wasn't before?
I would suggest that I argued in my reply brief that it goes back all the way back to Gregg versus Georgia, where the United States Supreme Court said that the death penalty cannot be imposed in an arbitrary and capricious manner. Mm-hmm. And we're at the point in time, almost 40 years after Gregg, 39 years since Gregg was decided, where in fact, statistically, if you look at the people who've been executed who were not the actual trigger man in a felony murder situation where they didn't direct the trigger man, it's a freakish occurrence. And that's why I actually cited those cases from those various, I cited the actual number of defendants I could find that have actually been executed across the entire United States who were not the trigger man but were executed under felony murder. And it is an extraordinarily small number in the total number of executions. So I think it goes all the way back to
that. That doesn't mean, just as I was talking earlier, that group of cases is incorrect. In our application of that particular issue.
I'm sorry, I didn't quite understand what you said.
On the constitutionally, of a sense for a defendant who didn't participate in the actual killing. We've got a structure there. There's a group of cases that indicates that it's there's an analysis there. And so why is that incorrect? Because you seem to be saying, I may be misunderstanding, that this is arbitrary and capricious given this circumstance, but then the line of cases doesn't seem to support that.
Well, I think my response would be that in the passage of time, in the almost 40 years since Gregg came down, and Gregg came down after Furman basically took out of the old death penalty scheme, but that Gregg itself made the holding that death penalty can't be arbitrary and capricious. Now, you don't know what that is at the beginning, but I think as years go by, as cases come and go, you can see what happens and what doesn't happen. And I would suggest that the 39 years since Gregg point to non-shooters or non-person with lethal blow in a felony murder case being executed has, in fact, at a nationwide level, made the execution of those people arbitrary and capricious.
What about in this case where we have loads of mitigation circumstance where the jury finds no mitigating circumstance? I mean, could that help us with the mandatory review to answer Justice Hardy's question?
Well, I was kind of puzzled that the jury found no mitigation in this case because it certainly is a bizarre. I mean, I'm not going to excuse Mr. Rodriguez's actions one bit, but the evidence they had from that about the horrific upbringing from his stepfather, Mr. Brezeno, is like, if that's not mitigation, being raised in that isn't mitigation, I don't know what is, but the jury chose not to find that.
And that's what we run into in a lot of death penalty cases, where some juries list a bunch of mitigating circumstances, and then they just say that the mitigation doesn't outweigh the aggravating, outweighs the mitigating, and they give death. But in this case, it's just they didn't find any mitigating circumstance. So
and like I said, I found it kind of puzzling in this case as well because there was lesser mitigation, certainly that he had a relationship with his daughter and things of that nature, but the horrific childhood he had, I wouldn't wish on my worst enemies.
Counsel, in this case, you've advocated arbitrary and capricious. Why in this case is it arbitrary and capricious if we accept the arguments you're attempting to make?
I think it's arbitrary with this issue. I think we're in the same, frankly, I think we're in the same position that Mr. Furman was in. The actual imposition is so arbitrary and capricious. Whether this case or the next case down the line.
I'm talking about this case. This is the case that's stored up. This is the case you want us to write on. Why should we do it? How would you write it?
I would say that it's arbitrary and capricious, not so much uniquely because of the fact of this case, where I'm trying to I'm probably saying very inartfully, Justice Douglas, it's that in the 39 years since Gregg, we're at a point where this case or any other case, it's arbitrary and capricious to execute the non-trigger man in a felony murder case.
Especially when the
Technically, the co-defendant doesn't get death, yes.
Yeah, and the jury's not told that the trigger man did not get death.
So that would be a per se rule?
I would say yes. My position, I did not make that a fight argument.
We are to forget that, but for him saying, we should go rob this lady, she has a safe, I have a key, she has money.
She's paralyzed and in a wheelchair.
I'm not excusing the homicide. I'm not at all. That's not my argument at all, Your Honor. Thank you. I thank the court for their time.
Thank you both, counsel, for your participation in oral argument and your excellent briefs. I'm sure it's challenging to be under the gun with all these questions, but we appreciate your input sincerely. The matter will stand submitted.